Welcome to From the Booth, the podcast sponsored by the BYU International Cinema Program. I'm Chip Oskerson, co-director of international cinema with fellow co-director Mark Yamada. How are you doing, Mark?
Great. It's great to be here.
Yeah, we had a great week last week at international cinema. Great films playing, a couple comedies, a classic film, and a documentary that all seemed to play really well. We're going to be talking about those today. We're also going to be previewing films that will be coming up in the week of the 22nd to 25th of January. When we preview those films, we promise not to give away too much for you, but we will give you some things to listen for. So the films that we want to start by talking about are The Godfather. This, of course, is Francis Ford Coppola's classic film from 1972. And then two comedies, as I mentioned, Blinded by the Light and Tel Aviv on Fire, both from just the last couple years. And then lastly, we're going to have a conversation with George Hanley, a professor from Comparative Arts and Letters, about Cordillera of Dreams. But let's start with The Godfather. There was quite the buzz about this.
There was. Yeah, I mean, we got a great turnout, especially Saturday night. It was full. We were at capacity. People were streaming in, which was a little surprising to me just because this film is, I mean, it's an older film, but it's played on TV. I think it regularly plays on TV. And so maybe people just wanted to come out and see it on the big screen, but it was a really interesting, fun kind of screening of it.
Yeah. How did the audience react? I mean, the style, it's a 70s film, so there's, you know, the kinds of techniques that are used, of course, different.
Different style of film. They were right there, though, and I think that there was a little bit, I mean, there's audience members who kind of knew the cliches of kind of the mafia films, right, which are, you know, just like one after another in this film.
Because it's establishing those cliches.
Establishing
right?
those cliches, even though that we, you know, they seem kind of old hat for us now. I mean, this is kind of the origins of that, and they would kind of be right there with them. And then they would laugh at some of the jokes. I mean, I think they were looking for a little bit of levity because it's a very serious film, and so whenever there's something mildly amusing happening, they would kind of latch onto that. But I mean, they were excited. There's the ending of the first part that we showed is that kind of well-known scene in the restaurant where Michael takes vengeance, right, on those who tried to kill his father.
He crosses the Rubicon, so to speak. He is now part of the family
business. I think there was this kind of applause, right? People were so excited about this. I mean, there was this kind of...
I don't know if that was the reaction we really were going for.
Well, yeah. But it was a fun showing. So it'll be interesting to see how many people, if our attendance lags at all in the second part, if people are, interested in coming out and seeing in the second part, or if they went home and maybe saw it on whatever, online.
Yeah, that's right.
couldn't wait until the end.
Yeah, that's interesting, though, that's... Because I think our feelings are supposed to be a little bit ambiguous there, because, of course, this is a horrible act of violence, this vengeance for his father's attempted assassination.
Right.
And it represents, for the Michael's character played by Al Pacino, this is the turning point. There's no going back after this, right? That he's going to be so fully part of what the family's doing, and up to this part, he hasn't been able to do that. So it's a loss of innocence.
Yeah.
It's a loss of... I mean, any kind of purity, insofar that there is this kind of, I mean, the good old days are gone, so to speak, for him.
It's that expression of loyalty, right, that I think we see a lot in the mafia films.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something about his family, though, that it's not, and he refuses to get involved with drugs. I mean, there's a certain kind of honor, right, that is preserved a little bit in the Corleone family. And so I think we look at it as kind of this, this loyalty moment, right, where Michael kind of comes.
But that's interesting, though, that for our audience here, that loyalty is worth celebrating, even though it has resulted in this horrible act of violence. Which, I mean, I don't know. We need to kind of check ourselves a little bit, right?
Right. I mean, part of it is that you have. I think what's really interesting. My second time seeing it. And I saw it a long time ago. But I really love how the beginning, that monologue with the man who's coming to the Godfather for help.
Right, this slow zoom
in space
really helps to accentuate it.
Right, which is kind of in contrast to that slow zoom in that you have with Michael later on that I think Darryl talked about on Wednesday. But you have this he's speaking in kind of a heavy accent.
Yeah.
And so even though it's 1946, 47, I mean, you're recalling kind of this immigrant, the kind of the roots of the mafia in America, right, which is this kind of... other America. I mean, you have the America of opportunity, of civilization, and yet you also have the immigrants who depended on, early on, some of these, these godfather-like figures in order to get opportunities, in order to have these kind of things. And you get really kind of recall back to that idea, right, of this other side of America that's kind of brought out maybe later on in the second Godfather a little bit more.
Well, and I especially the way that it's framed. I mean, he starts off, I think his first line is, I'm a good American. I try to be a good American,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so he recounts this man who's coming to the Godfather for help. He first goes through and talks about how he's done everything he was supposed to do as an immigrant to the United States.
Right.
And justice has failed his family. There's right. some men that did that abused his daughter, left her disfigured, and were not held account by the courts.
Yeah.
And so he's now turning to the Godfather for help.
Right.
And it really is pointing towards, I think, what, and you're kind of indicating this, I think, by the placement of this film right after the end of the Second World War.
Right.
There's this kind of question of, well, you know, why was the mafia, why did it have appeal? And part of it was because people maybe didn't always feel that in the American dream that is kind of presented, that, you know, becomes the 50s, this kind of idealized American life, that of course people that are left out of that,
right.
And where do they turn to, right? That this is what they're turning to.
Yeah.
And
he's kind of at the center of this other kind of society. I mean, there's this undertaker who comes to him, there's a baker later on who everyone's kind of coming to him for help, and he's not just this kind of rash, you know, tyrant. I mean, he has a system of, there's a system, right? He has this sense of justice, right? He says, that's not justice, that you're what you're asking me to do, right? And so it's interesting how that all kind of develops, and Michael's kind of caught between, right? He's caught between this kind of American boy, war hero, college boy, you know, that they kind of treat him as, and then also eventually kind of pulled into this other America, right? That he kind of is going to be rising in the ranks of eventually, but yeah.
Well, and it has its own code, you're right, that and it's a delicate balance that gets out of balance every now and again, right? That there's, you know, violence erupts between families, and then it's, you know, it's kind of reestablished. And of course, this is the trajectory of the film, is that with the absence of the Godfather, there's this power vacuum that needs to be filled, and Michael, in the second half, is going to have to decide how he's going to navigate
where
this.
Where that leads, that'll be interesting to see. There's a scene where someone's executed. I think it's somebody who they think is responsible for this hit on the Godfather. And when he's executed, you see in the background, you have a Statue of Liberty.
Yeah.
I mean, so in some ways, these two Americas kind of merge a little bit. I mean, Michael's war service almost becomes not other to kind of his mafia service, but really it helps him out, right? I mean, he's cool under pressure.
Yeah.
Unlike, you know, his older brother who's too rash, right?
Yeah.
And his younger brother who's too weak, right? And he's kind of that in between, that perfect. And because of those very characteristics, he's maybe one suited to take on the family business, right?
Yeah.
They aren't. So, yeah, interesting film. Visually, though, I mean, it's, again, watching the second time, just the way that Coppola kind of sets up this whole idea of being outside of the family and then being inside the family. And there's that wedding photo where, you know, they're all kind of lined up and the Godfather's in the middle, and they have, you know, the blocking is really amazing because Michael's on the edge in his army outfit. And, you know, the camera pans and he said, let me grab Diane Keaton Kay, right, and bring her in, and kind of pulls her all the way into the family, and they're on the edge, and they're not dressed like everyone else.
Yeah.
And then the way that they eventually kind of become, Michael becomes like the family, that one zoom, that one kind of shot where he pulls in and captures him talking and in some ways giving orders.
Yeah.
Like he would, like a Godfather would, is really kind of interesting.
Yeah.
So that kind of gradual process of him kind of being pulled in, I think, was really well
done. I really like that, the whole kind of opening sequences where there's the inside the office and then outside in the family wedding, right?
Right.
And it is that kind of inside outside replicating the way. And that inside, it's all about these, you know, it's a very kind of dark, it's reds and blacks,
right?
And then outside, it's, you know, all these pastels and,
right.
you know, kind of other colors. And that inside outside is, there's this interesting contrast, which of course, what everything hinges on with the mafia, right? But those who are in the know, those who are inside the circle, those who are outside.
Really interesting.
Well, there's some other really great sequences. We'll talk more about these next time in the second half.
Really
there's
interesting,
some interesting montages where action is set over and against each other to really drive home the contrast of you know of what Michael is needing to decide to do in this. Okay, well, another one of the, I mean, shifting gears, you know, rather radically here in some ways. Let's talk about The Boss. Let's talk about Bruce Springsteen a little bit. Blinded by the Light, Narinder Chadha is known for Bend It Like Beckham. This is kind of another intercultural comedy, in this case about a young girl who wants to be a soccer star and is kind of going against, you know, culture. She's a director who is herself living between cultures, in that she's Indian, living
in London,
Britain,
right?
And has done most of her work in the UK. So this is familiar territory here for
right.
her.
Yeah, and in some ways the film is about her. It's about, I mean, the star of the film is a man named Sarfraz Manzoor, who's a journalist.
Based on a true story.
Based on a true story. Yeah. Wrote a book, I guess, which is in some ways what the story is based on.
Mm-hmm.
But he's Pakistani, family immigrated to London. So kind of a similar experience in that way.
Although not quite to London, right?
Or, sorry,
to Luton.
So not exactly.
It's not exactly.
Not exactly London.
It is. Yeah, I kept thinking that Luton must be to London what New Jersey in some ways
is to New
York City.
That's
right?
Interesting. That's interesting to think about. Then that way, the music of Bruce Springsteen makes sense in that way.
Yeah.
New Jersey is always kind of the ugly stepchild to kind of New York, right? Or kind of the ignored, yeah. But
now you lived in Manhattan growing up. I lived in New Jersey, so we'll take this out back afterwards.
That's right. But I think that's interesting that he does, like, I mean, the music brings Bruce Springsteen, and I've heard this before about his music, and I've listened to him growing up, and I always thought of him as kind of like all-American, but I've heard this from other people around the world, and the way in which his music's been appropriate, that he does speak to people everywhere.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that, you know, this guy from New Jersey who's talking about the blue collar and kind of, you know, frustration about class and things, kind of an American experience, really kind of resonates with this one person living in England and dealing in some ways with, you know, prejudice and his own kind of issues with class and struggles. So I really like that, the way in which Bruce Springsteen, even though we don't think it might, really in some ways kind of speaks to people and gives this kind of vehicle for them to, you know, to express their frustration, right?
Well, I think it says a lot about the way that global culture works, right?
Yeah.
And you call it a period piece almost. I mean, it's set in the 80s,
right?
So, and it evokes a lot of the typical things that we associate both with Bruce Springsteen and Bruce Springsteen's music, which is a certain kind of style, as well as what I would call kind of English mod,
right?
You know, that they're kind of at odds with each other.
That
does a really good job with that. But I really like how it is showing the way that texts travel across boundaries and borders. And what I thought made this film better than it might have been, I mean, it might have been just kind of a cutesy, you know, vehicle to play some Bruce Springsteen music.
Right.
But it seemed to be more sensitive to the complexity of the transmission of text, and in this case of songs and of music, in that there was a recognition that it's echoing here, right? It's resonating with our main character, who, you know, finds his way to deal with the racism that he's confronting, with the poverty and the lack of opportunity, his frustrations with his family, all of these things. But he also recognizes the limit of it as well.
Yeah.
And that it's not just that I can simply be Bruce Springsteen in Luton. It doesn't work quite that way. He has to make the even more difficult translation, you know, of it.
Yeah.
And that's what I think that the film is really trying to work out, is how does he come to this in-between space, actually. It's not just about becoming Bruce Springsteen.
Right.
It's
about
becoming Javed in Luton, inspired by Bruce Springsteen, with these kinds of, you know, concepts and I don't know, models in a way to kind of think through and to experiment with. But ultimately, he has to find himself. And that self is not rejecting his family, but finding a way to still be a part of his family. And I really like that complexity, as opposed to just be an individual, go off on your own and follow your dream.
Yeah, this kind of, what, American dream that's kind of spread, right?
Yeah,
it's more
he has
this,
loyalties to his family.
He has a different kind of situation. And at the same time, like you said, he selects certain elements of the Bruce Springsteen kind of culture, right, in order to kind of incorporate and see his father as this guy who believes in some of the same values that maybe Bruce Springsteen believes in. So.
Yeah.
It is interesting. And Bruce Springsteen's not, I thought that he might make a cameo.
He didn't.
And I'm kind of glad that he didn't. Because it makes
right.
it more about him and his experience with the music. He goes to New Jersey, I think, for some reason later on in the film.
Yeah, he goes there he wins a contest, right?
Right.
And so it shows him visiting all the Bruce Springsteen sites, but of course he doesn't actually see
right.
them.
But I think that was good about that, because it didn't become about Bruce Springsteen. It became about somebody whose music, or who, listening to Bruce Springsteen's music, was able to kind of apply it to a certain degree to their life. So,
Something something else I liked about the film, and I'm a little bit on thin ice here because I don't know enough about the Bollywood musical tradition really to make strong arguments this way. But it seems to me, at any rate, that the director is very much channeling a kind of Bollywood musical in the way that they break out into song and dance. It's kind of loosely tied into the to the storyline, but you know, there's some really great sequences actually where I felt like I was watching something like a Bollywood musical. And I hope I'm not just saying that because I know that the director is is half Indian.
Right.
But there seems to be a little bit of a connection there, and it's certainly fun if nothing else.
Yeah.
Well, we had not one, but two comedies at International Cinema in the same week, which I don't know if this is completely unprecedented. We're not always known for showing our comedies.
Right.
But Tel Aviv on Fire, which is a comedy that's set against the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And again, using humor, I think, in a way to get at pretty serious problems and pretty intractable problems. This is one thing I liked about this film, is that it really recognized that don't just paper over the complexity of this, And so the basic plot is that this guy who's kind of just a loafer, he's working as, kind of a gopher on the set of a soap opera, suddenly finds himself in the position to needing to help write this. And he has no idea what he's doing. And so he starts taking ideas from this Israeli captain who works at the checkpoint that he has to go through every day to get to work. And of course, the Israeli has some very definite ideas about the way this Palestinian, soap opera should be running, and starts putting pressure on him that it needs to end in a certain kind of way, right? That is, of course, much more favorable to the Israelis. And this, puts him in a dilemma of how does he remain true to the Palestinian experience, at the same time kind of appease the pressure that's being put on him. One thing that really comes out to me, and that this is something that I thought about first in terms of the documentary Gaza that we showed last semester about the Gaza Strip,
right,
is that the main character here, Salam, is he has no power when it comes to dealing with the Israelis. He's going through this checkpoint. He is completely at their mercy, every single day to what they want, to what they need, to what etc. And likewise, with Gaza, that it really drove home to me that there's a fundamental inequity of power in this situation that we have in the Middle East, and it's not just in the Middle East; it's in all different kinds of places in the world. But when there's this kind of imbalance in power, there simply can't be justice, right? And so it's being done in a very playful way, but that's really a lot about what this film is about, is that Salem can't ever kind of meet this guy on a level playing field. And, the Israelis have what feels like almost all the cards. And it really leads to, kind of desperate situation. The compromise at the end is, of course, kind of playful in that the wedding that this Israeli captain wants the season of the soap opera to end with the Palestinian spy, who's the kind of the main heroine in the story, to marry the Israeli general, right?
Yeah.
It's a validation of Israel's kind of supremacy and all these kinds of things. And of course, Salem can't do this, and nobody on the show really wants it to end that way too. And so the ending that they come up with is clever in that she's going to marry him, but it's interrupted by the Israeli soldiers kind of storm the wedding at the end.
Right.
And for a Palestinian, of course this is how it this is how it ends.
Yeah.
For the Israelis, their honor is kind of preserved at the same time because they've shown their supremacy. And so there's this moment that, towards the end of the film that I think is really good, where they're sitting down, over hummus, which is itself kind of an interesting symbol in the film. And they're going to both eat this bowl of hummus and recognize that there are fundamental differences and that we're not just going to paper over those, but that in trying to work together, we're going to try and take that first kind of step at mutual understanding.
Yeah.
And comedy's good at that. Comedy's good at diffusing some of those kinds of tensions that otherwise exist.
Right.
So to talk about the Cordillera of Dreams, we have with us today Professor George Hanley from Comparative Arts and Letters. He's a professor of interdisciplinary humanities. He's the author of research both on the environment and theology, as well as the author of several works of fiction, among them American Fork, which is relevant for our discussion today about Cordillera of Dreams, in that it's about a woman from Chile who's living here in the United States as a student and kind of interweaves her experiences here in Utah with kind of coming to know the environment here with her experiences and family history in Chile. So this is an area that that Dr. Hanley has thought quite a bit about. Thanks for being with us on our podcast today.
Thank you, Chip.
So tell me your overall impressions of this film. Maybe for our listeners who don't know a lot about the context, you can talk a little bit about what this film is set, what's the backdrop of this film?
Sure. Well, one thing that's important to realize is that this is telling a story that has only been more recently told in Chilean history. Back in the 1970s, Salvador Allende was elected in the early 1970s, was elected to be president of Chile, and he was a Marxist. So he was actually the first democratically elected Marxist in history, and was, to be accurate, he was elected by a minority of the population because they had many parties. So I think, it was roughly a third or maybe 40%, I can't remember exactly, that elected him. And it was a very contentious presidency because of his policies were pretty aggressive and nationalizing a lot of things. The country was suffering from intense economic problems. And those problems were exacerbated, or his ability to solve those problems was exacerbated by a lot of political resistance to his presidency.
Both within and without the country, right?
Yes,
I mean, the United States
yes.
was not excited about Marxist government in South America.
Correct. Yeah, and eventually that led to a CIA-sponsored coup on September 11th, of all things, 1973, and he eventually kills himself inside of the presidential manor. And the ensuing dictatorship, which was a military-led coup, and the general of that military resistance uprising was Pinochet, who became the leader of Chile for the next many years, was first several years and maybe upwards of a decade or so afterwards, there were many political repressions that led to Chileans going into exile, including Guzman, the director of this film, many writers and artists and political leaders and intellectuals and progressives of various sorts, and to the kidnapping and disappearance of many people. And to this day, they don't have exact counts, but they are, since the early 2000s, Chile has been trying to more accurately document that history, try to determine the location of the disappeared, many of whom were buried in mass graves. And this was a subject of some of Guzman's other films, but it's been very difficult to recapture that history. So that's one of the reasons why the film is interested in showing this documentation of the street violence. A lot of that street violence was not actually visible to Chileans unless they happened to be witnessing it firsthand. It was never available on television. So in recent years, footage of protests and of police brutality has been shared widely in Chile to help document that history. So the film is really playing on that idea of the documentation of history as an alternative history. If you're a fan of A Man in the High Castle, I couldn't help thinking about, you know, that commonality with that show, where documentary film is sort of the ultimate resistance to totalitarianism. So there's something about that raw quality of eyewitness accounts, and you see that very clearly in the case of the filmmaker, I've forgotten his name, Pablo, who's you know, has a lot to say.
Yeah, Pablo Salas.
He has that whole room full of documentary films and footage of simply just eyewitness accounts of what happened. But I think there are a couple of reasons why this film is really sort of important for us. One is, I've always been struck, having traveled to Santiago a number of times, at the similarity between Salt Lake City, or at least the Wasatch Front, and Santiago, in terms of the shape of the mountains and the city and the weather. But more importantly, I think the film is talking about a moment of intense polarization, so much so that it becomes a contestation about truth and about who's telling the truth. And there's some sort of frightening warnings in there, in particular this idea that I think it was Pablo who says this, but people who were looking the other way and enabling torture and disappearances of political enemies were entirely convinced that they were doing what was right,
right.
And that they were doing what was necessary for their country. It's also a time where, as he's pointing out, the mountains are for sale. The natural resources of Chile are for sale. He's insisting, of course, in the film that this is the current economic reality of Chile, and that this
Directly back to the coup, right? That they brought with it an economic model that was opposed to what Allende was proposing and trying to bring about, and that's the model that's still at play today. That the actors who are behind it, I mean, he's pretty incriminating, right?
Yeah.
And saying that the main actors behind it are still in power, are complicit, actually in the violence that took place.
Yeah, it's a fascinating situation. And when you look at the natural wonders of Chile, which are extraordinary, it's really an amazing place. And there are opportunities for national parks and preservation of the mountains and the watersheds and so on that is really uneven. And some of it has been facilitated by private businessmen, a very famous case of the owner of Patagonia who bought an enormous amount of acreage very controversially and then donated it to the government because they wouldn't do it themselves, essentially. Huh. But you can drive through many of mountain ranges and areas of rural Chile and you'll see mountainsides and hillsides that are sort of ruined or turned into tree plantations for export. So there's a real sense in which this film is tapping into a crisis of national identity, its beauty, and also its understanding of its own history.
It's interesting. He makes the people he's interviewing makes the claim at one point that the artist is the guardian of the beauty of a country.
Yeah.
And I thought there's a lot of emphasis actually placed on art. You already, referenced this cinematographer who, has hundreds of hours of, kind of filmed, protest. But in addition to that, he's interviewing sculptors and writers and others as a way to get at this parallel that he's wanting to make between the mountains, the Cordillera, and the, mountains as witnesses of, this kind of tragedy. What do you make of that role of the artist that he's proposing?
Well, I think it's very moving to me. What's powerful about it is that he shows that that's a political act, right? That guarding beauty and celebrating beauty or commemorating it, glorying in it, it's not a sort of apolitical thing. It has political connotations, and the way we relate to beauty may have a lot to do with the kind of ideology with which we look at physical beauty. And that's true of human beauty as well as natural beauty, right? I mean, are we commodifying it? Are we selling it? Or are we in awe of it? Are we able to appreciate it? And so it's a very powerful image of understanding the mountains as an awe-inspiring form of beauty that's all but ignored, really, in the local culture. And yet, ironically, he's pointing out that these mountains are witnesses of the very history that Chileans are ignoring. So he's trying to tie the two together. Like if we were more responsive to natural beauty and wonder, we would also be more responsive to our own failings as a society. We would be more accountable. We'd be more responsible. And even though the film isn't really making a strong argument explicitly for preservation and conservation, I think it's there in the film that if we cared enough about preserving history, we would also be caring enough to preserve the natural landscape. And instead, it's all getting sort of sold.
It's interesting because he makes the claim at kind of early on where there's this interesting shot of the painting, the mural, kind of showing the mountains in the metro.
Yeah.
And the way that it's done is very clever in that you have it's hard to see because people are moving in front of it. The metro's in front of it. You can't quite make it out. And there's this slow, slow zoom onto this where we're finally able to see it. And then he does a lap dissolve onto an actual photograph of the mountains. And it's a very long kind of dissolve where you see the two images at once. But instead of cutting then to the mountains themselves, it actually returns to the representation of the mural of the mountains. And he says that this is how most people in Santiago see the mountains, is that they see the representation of them. And he makes the point of the matchboxes as well. And I wonder if what he's getting at here is that sometimes the idea of the mountains are more important to people than the mountains themselves, right? So that there's this idea, oh yeah, we have this fantastic natural beauty, it's out there somewhere, as opposed to any meaningful engagement. So, okay, what does that actually mean about how our behaviors and our actions are affecting those places, right?
Yeah, I think that's spot on. And I mean, what's interesting though, is the film doesn't really trace the environmental practices, although it alludes to the copper mines and the selling of the mountains and the natural resources. But it's more connected to this kind of ethos of the people, whether or not they're distracted or whether they're able to sort of pay attention to what's happening in the way that the mountains represent a kind of stillness that he seems to advocate in the people so that they could be more attentive to what's actually happened in their own history and to their country. So, like I say, I think it implies environmental care, but the film's much more interested in the political story.
Well, what's the takeaway from us today about that political dimension, do you think? Is there parallels that we can draw between what's happening in North America?
Yeah, I think we're in a terrible time of polarization right now, and the distrust between one party and the other right now in our country is really awful. And I think it's really becomes very problematic when you get to a point where there are two competing narratives about what is real, rather than two different interpretations of what should be done.
Yeah.
Right. And that's kind of where it feels we have gotten to as a nation. And I think the film is a strong warning about how dangerous it is to get to the point where we lose our sense of accountability to lived experience and what's actually happening to people. And so I think it's a call to care about the natural world. I think it's a call to care about the arts, and especially the arts that bear witness to human experience and to real lives, and to not turn away right from that sort of thing. And I think it's also a warning about the dangers of commercializing, commodifying everything. I think it is a tragedy that a country like ours, even our own mountains right here in Utah, the Ochre Mountains, are, over where the Kennecott copper mine is, are inaccessible to people because it's not healthy.
Yeah.
So we've sold that mountain, right? We've sold that. It's not just a mountain; it's a mountain range.
Yeah.
We're not that much better off. we have to be really careful, I think.
Okay. Well, George, thank you so much for sitting down and talking with us a little bit about Cordillera of Dreams.
Yeah, you're my pleasure. Thanks.
Okay, now we'd like to turn and preview the films that are going to be coming up for the coming week. The films this week is the second part of Godfather 1 by Francis Ford Coppola. That, of course, is from 1972. We have the film Photograph, directed by Ritesh Batra from 2019, Everybody Knows by Asghar Farhadi from 2018, and lastly, our documentary Anthropocene, the Human Epic from 2019. Let's start with The Godfather. We've already talked a bunch about this, Mark, so maybe we don't need to preview too much.
Sure.
But what are some things to look for in this second part?
Well, we get to see the fallout. What happens after the restaurant scene where Michael, chooses his family, becomes part of the family, and then really kind of goes past the point of no return. There's something about Michael, is he's decisive, right? And this is really kind of going to lead to his kind of really further his development as a character, but really lead to kind of war among the families. And we'll see what happens with that. And we'll see where his journey takes him and the progress that it leads and where he goes from here in terms of bridging that divide between the kind of that upright kind of America and then that the underworld that he's inheriting his father.
Yeah, that's right. The next film is Photograph. This is a film from India, a Bollywood film, but not a Bollywood musical or comedy. It's a I'm not quite sure how I would. It's not a drama, but it's a love story between classes. And so I think one of the things that is interesting about this film is the way that it kind of leads us into this relationship between these two people coming from two very different places. I should say, in some ways, it's a little bit of a comedy. There's a grandmother in it who's putting pressure on her son to get married. He's from a lower class. He works as a street photographer, and he takes a photograph of this woman that he falls in love with, right? And so it's, you know, how, but she's from a different way of life and entirely. This is made by the same director who made The Lunchbox, who some of our viewers might remember. That was a big hit from a few years ago. We've played it a couple times at International Cinema. And it's done with that same kind of sensitivity. Another thing that's interesting about this film is it's not 3 hours long, which it seems like, yeah. Every Bollywood film that we've shown recently, it seems like it's quite a long time. At 110 minutes, this is a different order of things. But there is some interesting kind of even philosophical dimension that they talk about. What is it that we come to understand in relationships with other people, particularly about the divine? And there's some really nice moments where they, they're trying to talk through what seem to be some pretty intractable problems of trying to bring their two lives together. Some of these things resonate with us because they're kind of universal human conditions. Some of it, of course, is a little bit specific to India, that the way that class works in India is, of course, very different than in the United States, where we tend to at least have the hope of greater class mobility. And so these are some things I think that that people can watch for as they're watching Photograph. How about Everybody Knows?
Yeah, this is a really interesting film. It all-star cast, right? You have Javier Bardem and Penelope Cruz, who are married in real life, and our characters who are kind of related in this film. I don't want to give too much away, but it's a really interesting film, and it begins, I'm not giving too much away to tell you that it begins with a kidnapping. There's a family kind of coming together outside of Madrid, and something happens, someone's kidnapped, and this kidnapping leads to kind of this unearthing of a lot of family drama, a lot of rivalries, of anger, of kind of issues that had happened in the past that had kind of been festering. But ultimately, it's interesting because the plot of the kidnapping is really kind of what's going on, but you get really kind of the human relationships. In some ways deals with forgiveness, with this idea of karma a little bit, but also ultimately kind of resolves in a very interesting way. So it's a film that will really kind of surprise you, I think, about how deep it gets into kind of human relationships and human nature.
Yeah, well, great actors and actresses and outstanding director too, right? That this is the director of The Salesman from a few years ago that won the best foreign film from Iran, and is really a good director. So it's high hopes going into this one. Well, the last film that we're showing this week is Anthropocene, the Human Epic. And this is a film that is directed by Jennifer Bakewell. Edward Bertinsky, who's a famous photographer, and Nicolas de Poncier, came out this last year. And Anthropocene refers to a proposal by stratigraphers and geologists to rename the geological epoch that we currently inhabit, to rename it from the Holocene to the Anthropocene. And the point of the documentary is not so much to get into the particulars of that argument, but they use their basic definition to visualize what is going on. The general argument with the Anthropocene is that humans have become such a force on the planet for changing the planet that you can talk about them now as a planetary force, that there is a definite marker that, eons from now you'll be able to go back to and say, okay, something happened different at this point, right? That there's kind of a line in the rock that's, that's different. And so they go through the different things like extraction and the really kind of the large scale sorts of things that we're doing as humans that have been both slowly and in some ways quickly changing the very planet that we live on. This is, of course, we've taken this title and used it for our semester series. We wanted to put this early on in the semester because it really helps to set the table well for the kinds of issues that we want to be getting at with some of these other films that are all talking about the human relationship to nature, to the environment, to the planet. One of the powerful ideas of the Anthropocene, I think, from a philosophical standpoint, is that it tries to get away from this idea that humans are always simply a problem, and that this has kind of plagued environmental discourse for at least the last three or four decades, where every time you kind of talk about humans, well, they're the things that have messed things up. And it's not to say that humans haven't messed a lot of things up, but it kind of paints you into a corner if this is the way you're always talking about it, because does that mean the only solution is to get rid of humans? Well, that's not a very moral or ethically savory, kind of proposal, of course. And so don't we need to start thinking about, well, how do humans exist on this planet? And how can they maybe exist in a more sustainable way going forward? The Anthropocene recognizes that humans are here to stay, that they are part of all of these systems. You have the carbon cycle, the water cycle, the nitrogen, you have all of these cycles, and humans now participate in all of these cycles and are a factor that have to be considered in these things. That's what Anthropocene is getting at. Edward Bertinsky, who's one of the credited as one of the directors here, is a well-known photographer, as I mentioned. Some people might know his work from the documentary he also did with Jennifer Bakewell called Manufactured Landscapes from 2008. And what I like about Bertinsky's work, he's very interested in showing and having you kind of draw your own conclusions about things. He doesn't want to necessarily tell you that this is a good or a bad thing. It's just a thing. And he's such a good photographer that there's always an aesthetic dimension to it. And so sometimes you're looking at something going, well, that's really stunning and beautiful. Oh, but that's kind of horrible at the same time.
Yeah, like a factory floor or something.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Exploited, but yet it's really beautiful, right?
Yeah, there's something aesthetically kind of pleasing. And he uses that kind of power to draw you in into a relationship, to it, kind of showing us the way the world is. He really likes playing with scale. Things of enormous scale that are hard for us to wrap our heads around in a lot of cases. So this is Anthropocene. We have the privilege of having a lecturer come in this week from Vanderbilt University, Professor Jennifer Fay, who's going to be introducing the film on Wednesday, the 22nd of January at 5 p.m. The title of her lecture is Imaging Deep History in the Present. She'll be talking about this film's particularly as well as Anthropocene cinema more generally. If you're interested, she'll also be giving a lecture earlier that day, that is the 22nd of January at noon in the Kennedy Center, 238 of the Harold R. Clark Building. And the name of that lecture is How Can Cinema Help Us Think About the Anthropocene? So it's a big day on Wednesday. We're glad that she was willing to come out and talk about this. She just published a book on Anthropocene cinema that's been really very well received. So, Mark, there's a lot to look forward to this week.
A lot of stuff,
going on. Well, thank you for joining us today on From the Booth. Our podcast is produced by the International Cinema Program at BYU, sponsored by the BYU College of Humanities. The hosts and guests of this podcast are solely responsible for the opinions and ideas expressed here, as they don't necessarily represent any official position adopted by the university or its supporting institutions. As always, we thank our sound engineer, Jojo Hegstrom-Pratt, as well as the staff of the BYU Humanities Resource Center for their help and support. Until next week, we hope to see you at International Cinema in 250 the Kimball Tower.
Okay. See you next time.